Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of Winesdown, on behalf of JBD, welcome to this event. Is it easy to be green and Jewish? With apologies to Kermit the Frog.
Is he Jewish?
Very good. My name is David Werding. If you don't know me, I'm president of JBD. We do all sorts of events like this in and around the city, and we'd like to have them all over the city, so I'd like to thank Eugene and GMK Partners for hosting and sponsoring lunch. Lots of other things that we do are available on our website, jbd.org.au, and especially coming up, we've got sukkahs in the city where there are at least 5 sukkahs within walking distance of the city, depending on where you are. So please avail yourself of that. And I want to wish everybody a Shana Tova. The format today will be as follows. Senator Di Natale will speak for about 10 to 12 minutes. Then Rabbi Glasman will speak for about 10 to 12 minutes. And then we'll have the two of them up here and open it up to the floor for questions. We'll finish a little bit before 1:30, at which time Eugene will give a vote of thanks. We'll do Birkat HaMazon and finish with Mincha at 1:30. I'm sure the Senator is going to hang around for a couple of hours to field questions afterwards. Or not. So first, Senator Richard Di Natale. He was elected to the Federal Parliament in 2010. He's the Greens' first Victorian Senator. You up for re-election now?
No, I'm not.
No, okay. So you're not on that...
No, on the tablecloth.
On that tablecloth. Yeah, count to 97. His portfolios include health, multiculturalism, gambling and sport. Richard's achievements in Parliament so far include securing $5 billion toward Medicare-funded dentistry, which is a good thing. Winning a campaign to divest tobacco stocks from the Future Fund, a bit of ethical investments, and spearheading Senate inquiries into many issues of public significance. Senator Richard Di Natale.
Thank you.
Well, thanks very much for the opportunity to speak today. I'm going to try and keep things relatively informal. I'm very keen to open up the floor to questions afterwards. I think that's probably where we'll get most out of the discussion. I think I'll just start with a little bit about my own journey into the Greens. Before I do that, can I acknowledge Sue Penicue, who's our State Member of Parliament for Southern Metro, and we've also got our candidate for Melbourne Ports, Anne Birrell, in the audience somewhere. I've just lost... Oh, she is. So I just want to acknowledge both of them, and thanks for coming along today. Look, I think sometimes with conversations like this, it's helpful to get a bit of a personal perspective about what brought me... to the Greens and into the Senate. I'm a typical sort of product of the Australian multicultural experiment. Both my parents are Italian immigrants, came here after the war. Dad was in his late 20s, electrician, worked very hard, got me the opportunity to study medicine at Monash. I was lucky enough to get a medical degree and spent a number of years working in general practice, later in public health, and I spent a few years working in the Northern Territory in Aboriginal health. And I think it was there that I probably first became political. It was at that time I wasn't somebody who came from a student politics background. I was always interested in politics, but decided to take the next step and become active on the back of the experience I had in Indigenous health, where people would present with really enormous health problems, often the consequence of lack of employment opportunities, lack of education opportunities, inadequate housing and so on. And it really crystallised for me something that I'd felt intuitively all along, and that is that to improve people's health, you've really got to do something about factors that lie outside of the health system. And I decided to become active. I joined the Greens because I felt that they represented the values that that were close to my own heart, and values of tolerance and compassion, a strong commitment to environmental sustainability and so on. And so I made the decision to join. I thought I'd hand out a few how to vote cards at election time, maybe stuff a few envelopes, and before I knew it I was standing as a candidate. Back in those days, early 2000s, you drove past the office and you were being asked to stand as a candidate. We were on 2% of the vote, and you know, really just another voice in the political debate. And over the space of a short period of time, we've grown, and we've now got, as you're sure you're aware, balance of power in the Senate and share of balance of power in the lower house of this Parliament. I think nothing really symbolises our commitment to social justice as strongly and as clearly as our position on the issue of refugees and asylum seekers. For me, this is something that I feel very acutely, very deeply. I feel that we're in a period in the nation's history where we will be judged very harshly for the approach we've taken towards people who are doing nothing other than seeking our protection. And my view is that for a country that is as wealthy, as privileged as we are, being able to offer people protection is a sign of strength, not weakness. And I know that much of this debate has been framed as a debate around trying to deter people from drowning at sea, but there's nothing compassionate about terms like illegals when people are doing nothing other than what is their legal right to seek asylum in this country. It's been talked about in terms of floods of immigrants, border protection, and so I don't think this is a debate at all that's about concern for the welfare of refugees and asylum seekers. I think it's a political debate where both parties are now exploiting the issue for political purposes. I don't pretend for a moment that there is an easy solution to the issue. I think in the end what we're faced with is the least worst response. And in my view, we've got a series of measures that differ very strongly from either of the major parties, and that is we support very strongly an individual's right to seek asylum. The thing we don't want to do is to take what is a tragedy in many instances and compound it by sending young kids to mental illness factories offshore with no hope and being scarred as a result of that experience. And that's what we're doing at the moment. We are scarring a whole generation of young people as a result of our response towards this terrible tragedy. We should increase our humanitarian intake. We should process people here onshore, and we should do whatever we can regionally to give people access to safer pathways. And we have committed to investing much more in the processing of people regionally so that they feel that there's some hope and there's less of a driver to get here on a boat. But that's our view. It's strongly our view, and it's been a view we've held consistently now for many, many years. On the issue of climate change, we've been very strong and committed to the notion that we've got to listen to the science. I've trained in a scientific discipline. One of the things that being trained in a scientific discipline it teaches you is that you've got to respect the science whether you like the answers you get or you don't. And all the science is very, very clear. Things are getting worse in terms of climate change. The outcomes, both in terms of the environment, health and our economy, are all very, very significant, and we need to act and act now. And one of the things, again, that's most disappointing is that we've had that debate be politicised, I think for political reasons, rather than doing what we need to do, which is take strong action. And I'm disappointed that one of the first things the Rudd government did was to really wind back the strong action that was taken in the previous parliament. My own view, as the health spokesperson, I think that one of the most disappointing things of the debate at the moment is we've seen very little action on health as an issue. It's always identified as the most important issue for voters, and yet we've seen very little movement. The Greens have got, and this is something we've driven very hard, we want to see a big investment in oral health. There's no reason that we should treat the mouth separately from the rest of the body. We want to bring dental care into Medicare. We can afford it. We've got a costed plan over 5 years to do it. One of the things that I'm personally very proud of is that we spent the last term of the last Parliament working with the Health Minister to introduce a package of reforms, almost $5 billion, one of the most significant of which starts on the 1st of January. Young kids now, for the very first time, are going to be able to go to the dentist and have their dental care paid under Medicare. If you're aged between 2 and 17, 3.5 million kids are going to have Medicare-funded dental care, and we're very proud of that. It's $1,000 for 2 years, but it means that young kids are not going to stay at home having their oral health getting worse, presenting to emergency departments for extractions under anaesthetic and all the complications that flow on from that, something we're very proud of. I'm very strongly committed to a bigger investment in preventative healthcare. We've got policies, as you heard in the intro. One of the things we did was led the charge to get taxpayer dollars, your money, out of companies like Philip Morris, British American Tobacco, and so on. We think what the government did with plain packaging was an excellent initiative. We were very proud to support it, very pleased to support it, but we were disappointed that we continued that investment. And one of the things we did was we got $250 million out of the Future Fund investing in tobacco. It's something, again, that I think is one of the things that demonstrates what you can achieve if you've got different voices in the parliament. And I know people have talked about the hung parliament and many of the negative aspects, but a lot of good has come out of that arrangement. I won't talk too much more about sort of general policy issues. I'll focus on some of the issues that I think that have probably raised some interest amongst some of you, and that is the Greens' position on some foreign policy issues, for example, the Israel-Palestine question. I don't for a moment want to communicate to you that this is an issue that I am an expert in. It's an incredibly complex issue. I understand the debate that's gone on within the broader community. It's not an issue for me that I feel that I can change in any way. I think what we've demonstrated is that our party has a commitment to a two-state solution. There are people inside our party on both sides of this debate who feel very strongly that are presenting positions that are not Australian Greens positions. I want to make that really clear to you. And the most obvious case of that is the support of the BDS campaign by some members of the Greens in the New South Wales Parliament. I don't know how much more clearly I can say this, but I'll say it very, very clearly as I possibly can. It's not an Australian Greens position. It's not something that anybody in our Australian Greens party room, with the exception of one senator, has ever supported. And we continue to take the view that it's counterproductive. It's not a way of achieving a resolution to the question of Israel and Palestine. And I suppose I'm more than happy to take some questions on that, as I suspect there might be down the track. I'd like to think that what we can do is have a constructive dialogue around that question. As I said, one of the positions that we take is that those of us inside our own party are entitled to express individual points of view. In that sense, we are closer to the Liberal Party than we are to the Labor Party, although it has to be said that there have been statements made by members of the Labor Party on this question. For example, Doug Cameron, who has called, I think, the State of Israel a terrorist state, and people like Tanya Plibersek. I think there's an upper house MLC in New South Wales who has taken a very hardline position in support of BDS. All I ask is that you don't judge us, that is, don't judge the Greens, by a different standard to the standard you judge the other parties to. So, we do have the view that individuals are able to express a position. It is not the Australian Greens' position to support the BDS campaign. Perhaps I'll leave it there, because I'm really keen to throw it open to the floor, and I'm really keen to perhaps address some of the questions that might come up through the debate. So thanks very much for the opportunity.
Thanks very much, Senator. Rabbi Yaakov Glasman has served as the spiritual leader of the Northeastern Jewish Centre for 6 years. In 2001, he was appointed Chief Minister of somewhere a little bit closer, St Kilda Hebrew Congregation, a very old and respected synagogue. He was elected President of the Rabbinical Council of Victoria in November 2009 and served that position for 3 years, and now he's got so much more time on his hands. He demonstrates a keen interest in Jewish adult education and lectures broadly on religious and social issues. Rabbi Glasman.
Thank you, David, and thank you kindly, Senator, for your wonderful introductory words. I think that first and foremost, when we ask the question, is it easy to be Jewish and green, we need to define our terms. Greens is clearly defined because they have a party line and it's very clear and explicit on the website, and you know exactly what they stand for, and we appreciate that forthrightness and that candid expression of your values. Jewish Well, you know, they always say two Jews, three opinions, and I think nowadays it's two Jews, five opinions through inflation and social media and all the rest of it. But without question, what I'm referring to when I say Jewish is someone who views, whether religious or secular, someone who views the state of Israel as being central to their ethos. I think that a significant majority of mainstream Jews within the Australian Jewish community and the wider international Jewish community would put Israel centre front in its priorities. It's not simply because Israel was the place of refuge after the Holocaust. It is much more deeply rooted than that. Jerusalem is mentioned no fewer than 700 times in our Bible. It is our homeland. It always has been, and frankly, it always will be. That's the context that I wanted to discuss. And there's no doubt whatsoever that some of the policies of the Greens are very much aligned with that of Judaism, meaning the Torah, the biblical views. I think that the Greens' view on asylum seekers is, as you say, the best of a bad lot of options. Obviously, a number had to be put on. I think you've stated 30,000, which is clearly a lot more than the Labour and the Coalition. And as a Jewish people, we understand all too well the need for compassion towards refugees and being sympathetic towards them. As a descendant, a grandchild of all four of my grandparents, two of which are still alive, who are Holocaust survivors, this hits home. And I applaud that policy, as I do other policies which focus on environmental conserving the environment. And I apologise, I printed out about 60 pages because I had to. certainly, but I will use the back, the clean side.
Take
the
foot out of your mouth.
That's right. But that's right. And indeed, in the Torah, we have a concept of Bal Tashchit, the prohibition against wasteful things. You know, the great sages and rabbis would often have a piece of paper. They would, even if there was just a little corner that was remaining, they would use it for another note or whatever, and they would exhaust all of the resources appropriately without just discarding them. But the sober reality is that when it comes to a spectrum of different policies, some will tug at the heart more than others. And it is this sort of the elephant in the room, which I wanted to focus on a little bit, which is the Greens' position on Israel. And first and foremost, a lot of people will say, well, I mean, we're living in Melbourne, we're living in Australia. Who cares about a political party's international foreign policy on another country? Let's focus on the local issues. And that's an understandable argument, but the problem is that that's a rational argument, and a lot of people feel emotional about it, and emotions can run very deep and they run very strong. The sober reality is that Australia's policy, irrespective of which government it is, on Israel, is virtually ineffective in the international arena. Let's call a spade, even the US, the so-called power broker, the powerhouse, the heavyweights, themselves are having serious difficulties making any changes in the Israel-Palestinian conflict, how much more so a smaller player like Australia. But yet, it becomes a matter of principle. If you ask someone who supports same-sex marriages, for instance, you ask the question, what do you actually achieve by changing legislation and changing the Marriage Act to include same-sex couples as marriage instead of just partnerships or whatever it might be? The reality is that in Australian legislation today, same-sex couples, as well as de facto couples, still receive virtually all the same benefits, Centrelink, government benefits, etc., as do heterosexual marriages. So why the change? Why the need for the change? It's all ethereal. And the answer is because it is an emotive issue. And someone who's in a same-sex relationship feels that they're actually being hard done by if their marriage or their partnership is not recognised with the same validity and the same legitimacy as a heterosexual couple. It doesn't change anything on the ground. It virtually doesn't. It's simply a title. Now we can call ourselves married and not just civil union, as someone once said to former Prime Minister Julia Gillard. So in a similar context, it comes to the question of Israel. It's true. The Australian government's policy on Israel its relationship with Israel, its view on Israel, its position on Israel, will very unlikely be effective in terms of real change on the ground. But it is something close to our heart. I seek for legitimacy, I seek for support, I seek for moral support for Israel, irrespective of how I view Israel, whether as a secular state or the God-given land, as all of the nuances within the Jewish community come with. So it's critical to explore the official Greens policy on Israel. I accept, and did a bit of homework as well, and concede that the Greens' leadership, its federal leadership, does not support the BDS, and congratulations on that. The BDS is intrinsically a bigoted and racist regime or initiative, because it focuses and plucks out the one out of 193 imperfect countries or states and targets them for boycotts. Just because Lee Rhiannon or young Greens in New South Wales put on a poll to support BDS or question the legitimacy or the right of Israel to exist does not speak to the Greens' leadership. I can see that. What does speak to the Greens' leadership are their published policies. The policies on Israel, which are published on their website with the imprimatur of, assumably, of their leadership. And that's why I want to draw them up and perhaps get the ball rolling with regard to those questions. So if you'll indulge me. The devil, as they say, is in the detail. And I've looked in the detail, as I'm sure some of you may have as well, and find great difficulty with some of the terminologies, the choice of narrative that is adopted with regard to the Israel-Palestine resolution. I mean, take for example, it requires or calls for the immediate and unconditional withdrawal of the Israeli military from all Palestinian cities, towns, refugee camps, surrounding areas and transport routes, allowing freedom of movement of Palestinians within the West Bank and Gaza. The last time Israel did that, the withdrawal from Gaza, allowing that free area, it became a launching pad for missiles, rockets flowing into the south of Israel. There is not one mention of the deadly rockets in that particular resolution. There is reference to suicide bombers, but none to those rockets that are continually raining down in Sderot and places like that. And unfortunately, this is a result of a failed and incompetent leadership on the part of the Palestinian side, who do not know how to take the land that was effectively granted to them on a silver spoon and turn it into schools and flourishing areas and mosques to pray and parks to play. Instead, they demolished the buildings and turned it into a devastating and deadly area from which to launch massive missiles onto innocent children, who have to live in fear, not just the fear of their lives, but the psychological trauma that it comes with. The Greens will also call for the immediate dismantling of the separation wall. The separation wall was highly controversial when it was first begun, I believe in 2000. But if we look at the facts since then, as controversial as it may have been, it has saved lives. It has saved lives. In 2000, between 2000 and 2003 in July, there were 73 suicide bombers that infiltrated from the West Bank, where the wall is predominantly placed, which caused the deaths of 293 Israelis and in excess of 1,900 injuries. When the wall continued to be constructed, from August 2003 till the end of December 2006, that number of suicide bombers dropped, to 12 bombers, which is less than a quarter, almost a fifth, and brought down the number of fatalities to 64, and only 445 injuries. I say only, in contrast to the previous numbers. And in 2010, the overall terrorist attacks, including suicide bombers and other terrorist attacks coming from the West Bank, has dropped to 9. The separation wall has saved lives. Had the Greens resolution been issued back in 2000, I'd have no issue with it. But it was issued in 2010, after this study was done. Was there a look into the number of lives that it saved? It wants the immediate dismantling of the separation wall that would, without doubt, result or precipitate in further suicide bombers coming from the West Bank, most tragically. But moreover, we have to contrast that particular policy to other policies. You know, you look at all of the injustices that are going on around the world, all of the countries that are abusing its citizens, you look at what's going on in Syria, and you'd think that there'd be a massive list of resolutions from the Greens. And unfortunately, I hold in front of you, I mean, Afghanistan, pithy, one line, bring the troops home. Timor-Leste, three lines. Burma, three lines. Tibet, one little paragraph. The United States, one little paragraph, and so on and so forth. Comes to Israel and Palestine, all of a sudden, we have a three-page diatribe of point after point after point, criticising pretty much everything that Israel has done in very carefully selective wording. And I might point out further, at the end of this particular resolution, there is an addendum, a wonderful addendum to the Israel-Palestine conflict, which says, and I quote, given the continuing disregard by Israel of calls to hold settlement expansion in the occupied territories, including East Jerusalem, the Australian Greens, and it goes on to name another list of not particularly nice characterizations or calls about the state of Israel. Now, the Tibetans didn't listen, the Chinese didn't listen. Where's their addendum? East Timor didn't listen. Where's their addendum? Afghanistan didn't listen. Where's their addendum? Burma, and so on and so forth. Why is Israel the only one out of all of those countries that warranted this graceful addendum by the official federal Greens? So, in conclusion, that's some of the questions that I would want to ask of the Greens. I ask it very respectfully. You're a great guy. I just want you to know, Richard. And I have nothing against that. And I applaud a lot of the good work that the Greens are doing. But I think that this is an issue that lies centre and forefront in the consciousness of the Jewish mind, of the Jewish heart. And until and unless a more balanced approach to Israel is forthcoming, it's not so easy to be Jewish and green. It would be easy to be Jewish and green if the Greens' formal published policies would become a little more aligned with the centre and not the extreme left. Thank you.
Okay. Well, yes, Nat, we want you both up here. You can hug the remnants of a tree.
We'll open the floor for questions, recognising that Rabbi Glassman isn't running for office. Actually, you're not running for office either. So your questions may be direct to the Senator, but reasonable for Rabbi Glassman to throw in a Jewish perspective. So
who's had their hand first? Come on, Gary.
Senator, you spoke about, first of all, we're appreciative of the fact that the leadership does not support BDS. You spoke about other parties where, and in your party, everyone's entitled to their opinion and views to be. Other parties, Doug Cameron, Labor, Maverick, you've got a large percentage of New South Wales Greens that are in support of BDS, including Mr. Shoebridge, which is really a racist policy. So whilst it's very good to say we don't support it, that you've got a large percentage, you've got to deal with that. Second issue that I'd like to raise is education. Your policy on education in private schools. I don't know if you know the Jewish day schools, but the candidate for Melbourne Port may be able to inform you, maybe she won't be able to inform you. The Jewish schools, most of the Jewish schools, the process of admissions are not based on socioeconomic class, it's across the board. And yet you have such a strong view against private education, private schools. Maybe you should look more carefully into the Jewish day schools in particular.
Okay, so a couple of points. I think that your first question actually relates to some of the discussion we heard. And I just probably need to correct a few things. The policy on Israel-Palestine is not the policy that was read there. That was a resolution that was passed in 2010 at a time when there was a lot of debate internally, and it was seen as a way of trying to resolve some of the debate that was going on within the Greens. And it's fair, you're absolutely right, there are people within the New South Wales Greens. I think it's fair to say it's also largely limited to the New South Wales Greens, and there is David Shoebridge, an MP, an Upper House State MP, and Lee Rhiannon, who in the past have supported BDS. But it's also fair to say, if we're going to be accurate, that there is our Senate candidate, Kate Fairman, who may well be the next New South Wales Greens Senator, who opposes it quite actively. That we've got Jeremy Buckingham, who opposes it. That we've got other strong voices, members of Parliament in New South Wales, who oppose it. I think it's also fair to say that Doug Cameron calling Israel a terrorist state is not... they're not soft words. They're strong words, and they can be... I think they can be compared to those people who support BDS. The official policy on Israel-Palestine now is not the policy that was read out. It has been replaced by a very short form of words to reflect what exactly the point that you make. Because I think it's, if we're going to be proportionate, then why aren't we talking about many of the hotspots that exist right around the world where there are conflicts? And in fact, on Syria, again, we can perhaps show you later, but we have put out some very strong statements. Senator Milne has released a very strong, a long statement on the issue of Syria. The point is that the policy was an old policy. You yourself mentioned it was an old resolution, 2010. It's now 2013, and it's been replaced with a form of words that are much more consistent with what we have to say about other conflicts. It's not, and I think it's been characterised as though the leadership doesn't support it. That's inaccurate. It is not an Australian Greens policy. It's nothing to do with the leadership. There are 9 senators who have an official party position on this, all of whom are in agreement. There are states where we have MPs represented, none of whom have official positions in support of the BDS. So it is accurate to represent this as a very small group segment within the New South Wales Greens who continue to support it. I think that's just... Now, that may not still be enough for some people, but at least I think make a judgment on those facts. The second question is a question of school funding. I can only speak in terms of the federal position here because every state will have their own view. The federal position is we support the Gonski reforms, which are agnostic about the public-private divide, largely. And it's a needs-based funding formula, and we think that's appropriate. It helps us move past this idea of, public-private and so on. And so we are strong supporters. In fact, we think those reforms should be fully funded rather than phased in over the long time frame that we're talking about. So that's our official position. Again, you might make your views, that might not change your perspective on the issue, but federally we support the Gonski package and we support implementing it fully. I think that probably deals with both of those questions. Would you like us to just take questions from the floor? Yep.
Yeah, hi. This is not a political one, if that's okay.
Yep. even better.
I'm a doctor working with St Vincent's, yep. And I also have a keen focus on preventative health, and I also have a belief that's backed by evidence that a lot of the change in diet has happened over the past 50 to 100 years, including introduction of sugars and processed fats, has led to a lot of the health problems we currently have now. And I had an idea, and this isn't my question, but I had an idea that a simple policy like making every single packaged item that contains added sugar to have to advertise that it contains sugar, or something along those lines, I think that would make a drastic change into the disease burden that the dietary things are causing us. But as a general question, how does someone who has an idea like that change policy?
Within our political party,
yeah,
for example.
Well, within how do I?
Okay. Well, I can't talk. Look, it's a big question. There are lots of different ways. You can join a public health group that advocates for that change and hope that there's the Public Health Association of Australia, there's the Obesity Coalition. There are lots of groups who are advocating for change, and you can decide to stay outside of the political process, but hope to influence policy within each of the major parties by advocacy through one of those organisations. You can join a political party. I can only tell you about the Greens and how the Greens work. You can join a political party. We have a policy development process. It's very democratic. People are able to express their views at our state and national conferences, and it becomes adopted as a party position. On both of those things, on that thing, I have to say that it's already an official policy position. So I agree with you, and I think it's not a hunch, it's a fact. I mean, the issue of increasing sugar intake and fat intake is contributing to obesity, along with the issue of our more sedentary lifestyles. But on both of those things, there are some simple things we can do. We support front-of-pack labelling, and we've been strong supporters. I mean, if you want to actually find out what's in a food product, you have to have a PhD in nutrition to decipher the nutritional information panel on the side, and it needs to be made much easier. So front-of-panel labelling is important. You're fighting hugely powerful interests, though, by that, because the food industry, particularly the processed food industry, don't want consumers to know what they're eating because, you know, it's scary. It's actually scary. So we are strong supporters of front-of-pack labelling, and there's been debate about whether it should be a traffic light system along sugar, fat and salt versus something like a star system, but we are strong supporters. And the other issue is advertising young kids, advertising of junk food to young kids during children's viewing times. We don't think that should happen, and we've got an initiative that would stop it.
Senator, thank you for your time, and Rabbi Glassman as well. I'm going to move back to politics, but away from Israel-Palestine.
Yes.
There's obviously much debate around the fact that this is a hung parliament and that Labour has only managed to form government by virtue of out of that, as well as the rest of the independents. We also saw a massive swing towards the Greens in the 2010 election. There have been a number of things that have happened in this parliamentary term, not least of which was Bob Brown resigning, somewhat surprisingly, which has led to, or rather, this is probably the essence of my question, but it has led to a detraction of support from the Greens, with Tony Abbott coming out and directing all preferences towards Labour in the seat of Melbourne, and obviously nationally as well. What does the future hold for the Greens, and have you peaked?
Big question.
As a journalist.
Okay. I've been a perennial loser in elections. So I've lost 7 elections before I was elected to the Senate. Most of them just flag-flying exercises. But I joined when we were on 2 or 3%. And at every election, our vote's gone up. We've got more senators now. We've balance of power in both houses. We've got state MLCs. We've been, you know, elected reasonably recently. Lots of local government candidates. So we've grown at every election. And yet at every election I get asked, has their vote peaked? You know, there are always people who are, I think largely a lot of it, it's wishful thinking. There are people who don't like us who would rather we weren't there and are looking at ways of, or reading the tea leaves and hoping that, well, this is going to be the sort of death knell for the Greens. We coming into this election, we face the issue of Adam not getting preferences from the Liberal Party. Now, if the Liberals decided that their real enemy was Labor and preferenced the Greens, that would be one of the safest seats in the country. Adam would win that with probably 10 or 15% margin. His challenge is that he's got to get over almost the Labor and Liberal vote combined. And the fact that he's still in the contest, I think it's going to be actually quite a tight contest, I think it's remarkable that a candidate for a third party is still in a contest where he has to leapfrog the combined vote of Labor and Liberal together. I think that in itself is a story. The Senate's going to be interesting because a lot of the Senate will depend on preferences. So our vote could go up, we might lose a senator, our vote could drop by 1% or 2%, we might pick up 1 or 2. Largely unknowable. Long-term trend, if you're in the 18 to 25-year age bracket, you're almost as likely... it's almost as likely that you'll vote for the Greens as you will for one of the big parties. So the demographics are actually good for the Greens. Whether you like us or not, it's just the way it is. I don't think the issue of climate change is going away, and I don't see any obvious evidence that either of our old parties are committed to doing anything about it. The issue of refugees, well, it's now obvious. If you care about... I mean, it was unthinkable that things could get worse than... under the Howard government, and yet Kevin Rudd's done something that John Howard didn't ever do, which he said, well, you come to this country, you've got a legitimate right to come here, you're fleeing persecution, and we're not under any circumstances going to give you protection. It's further than where John Howard ever went. So I think if you look at those issues, the social justice space has been vacated by the old parties. The issue of climate change continues to be, you know, it's getting worse, and yet the political response is retreating. The demographics are good for us. So whether we go up or down a percent at this election, for me, is, you know, neither here nor there. I'm confident that the long-term future's pretty good. Now, that's not to say we won't stuff it up. You know, the Democrats made some very bad decisions, and we know what happened. So this, you know, it's always harder for a smaller party because, unlike the old parties, where a third of the community are going to turn up to a voting booth and they're going to vote for you no matter what you do, because it's what their parents did and it's what their grandparents did. We don't have that. We've got to fight very hard for every vote. But over the long term, I'm confident that our vote will continue to grow.
I'm used to
extend
that question briefly.
We only have time for one more question. Sorry.
That's okay.
Andrew, and then we'll wrap it up.
Thanks. Firstly, thanks for addressing the group and congratulations on the tobacco industry divestment. It's looking, it's great. But just turning back to the Israel question,
yes.
You know, I did the ABC vote compass, which told me that I should be a Greens voter.
Right.
But I have a terrible, as Rabbi Glassman suggested, an emotional difficulty.
Yes.
And although perhaps from some points of view you could argue that BDS and those sorts of affiliated views are not mainstream Greens policy. I just wanted to ask you, what is it about the culture of the Greens as a place that's a home to a relatively large proportion of the representatives who are involved in supporting BDS?
Mm.
So that's one question. What is it about the group that creates a safe space for that sort of view to develop? Well, the second point is in relation to the published policies. It's interesting that you say those 2010 policies have changed. They're still on the website.
Yes, I know. Yes.
And I've seen Milne's comment where she articulates a small one-paragraph statement, but there's nothing in that statement that goes against the sort of reneges on the issues that Rabbi Glassman raised. For example, what really struck me when I read through your policies in detail was that there's a call for immediate and unconditional withdrawal of troops from the West Bank, implying with no regard to consequences.
Mm.
If you read the same policy about Afghanistan, the Greens call on Australia's troops to come back as quickly and safely as practicable. In other words, the second policy seems to give some weight to real-world consequence, whereas the original policy does not. And just briefly, the third point, really, to Robert Bassett, sorry, I just want to get these points in. I think Greens policy does have an impact in two ways. If you're a balance of power party, when there are votes in relation to international forum, and you've already got the Labor Party, which has a significant anti-Israel element, those collectively can influence voting. And secondly, when you've got large party candidates who are affiliating themselves with BDS, it gives credibility to them, and so I think there's a real-world effect.
Can I just...
Sure, yeah.
Before the Senator wraps it up, I just wanted to, on that point, Senator, I was aware that there was a new statement in 2013. I plucked out the 2010 one. It seems current on the website, but I think that's just to reiterate that point. I would love to see... the Greens have called for a lot of things from Israel initially. Mm. I would call, and I would love to see for the Greens to issue an official statement formally reneging and actually... revoking those calls that would ask for a dismantling of the separation wall, that would ask for an immediate and unconditional withdrawal, and I think that would placate a lot of the concerns that some of us have, rather than just ameliorating the issue by giving a motherhood one-liner statement and not actually looking back in the detail that was officially published. I would love that.
Okay. On that point, obviously, it's not a decision for me, but having said that, I'd like to come back here in a year's time and present you with, you know, a statement that was potentially along the lines that you suggested. It's not a current statement and it's been replaced, and be happy to come back and have that discussion if and when it was to happen. But I think the broader point is, I think you, in your statement you said it, what is it that a large proportion, 20-odd MPs... must be the local councillors, close to 100. Two MPs out of 20. And local government, I think we had 3 out of 100 local councillors who have supported the position. So from where I'm sitting, that's a tiny proportion. And, you know, I think it has to be said that it has been whipped up by largely the Murdoch press in the Australian. Okay, there's a journalist, Christian Kerr, who is literally camped, you know, outside of every Greens meeting with a view to try and pick up on anything that we might say that might be controversial. And God bless them, our people in New South Wales give them plenty of material to do it. So it is a small proportion. I'd also say that there's one of the things that happens when a party comes from the place that we have come from, a small party that's growing, and our membership's growing, unlike the other parties, as I said, all the trends are positive. And this was particularly true in the earlier days, is that if there are people who have agendas they want to run, they are much easier to get up, and particularly earlier on, they were easy to get up because we have a very democratic process, and if someone wants to fight to have a particular thing driven through our policy process, in the earlier days, if there were people who were either disengaged or not particularly interested in it, it would become policy. And so, in fact, take the Israel-Palestine question, there were, in health, I mean, I went back and read our health policy before we had our review, and it was, as a medical practitioner, it wasn't something, you know, some really good things in there, but it didn't give a sense of the balance of where we wanted things to, how we wanted things to change. And I think it's fair to say that that's true of international relations questions and so on. That addresses, I think, two of the points you made. The third point was probably, I think it was directed at you, Rabbi, so I'll think I'm probably done unless there are any other final questions.
No, great. All there.
Done. Thank you.
Thank you.
I was going to say, it takes a certain person to sort of get into the bear pit that's called Parliament. I think it takes an even classier person to actually come into the bear pit called a JBD meeting. So to Senator Di Natale, thank you for being so open and being so accommodating with your views and with your comments and things like that. To Rabbi Glassman, I understand that the week before, my rabbi says the week before Rosh Hashanah is very busy. I'm still to hear proof of it, but I'll discuss that with Anton as to how busy our respective rabbis are.
He's on leave this week.
He's on leave?
Why do you think I'm here?
I know the week before Rosh Hashanah is very busy, so again, appreciate your time in taking the time out to come and speak to us. On behalf of GMK Partners JBD, thank you both very much for taking the time to come and speak to us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the invitation.